All right, welcome everybody to the Sprint Jump Throw Performance Podcast. I'm Joel Reinhart along with Andrew Cormier. Today we have on for the second time Michael Zweifel. He is the owner of BBA Performance in Dubuque, Iowa. Thanks for doing this, man.
Thanks for having me on again, guys. Look forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we left off last time, it was mid-August, and you were getting ready to go into in the fall with some athletes who had maybe had, you know, seasons canceled, or they'd opted out of college seasons or anything like that, or were getting ready for potential pro careers. You were going to do kind of a top-to-bottom mock football season, and we kind of went over that a little bit of what you were hoping that would look like in the fall, and now we wanted to touch base to see what that actually did look like and you know, how it went, what things you thought went really well, what things you might want to tweak, and just kind of, you can kind of start that wherever you want, and then we'll bounce off that.
Yeah, so, yep, but you said that the plan was in the fall to give, at least where I'm at, all the, I'm not in any major universities, so it's all D3 NAIA, and high school kids as well, but the majority of those athletes had their football seasons canceled. So just like everybody else, their whole kind of fall was up in the air. And so we had about a group of 20, 25 kids that we did kind of like a mock season. We tried to, you know, somewhat, you know, mimic or, you know, try to put them through some sort of mock fall season. Like everybody's dealing with this past year and a half now, we ran into some interruptions. Some local universities like started fall practice and then, you know, would get shut down or do a week or two here. And then, you know, things would, you know, a wrench would get thrown in there. So like everybody else, there was a lot of, I think, you know, wrenches thrown into it that, you know, kind of disrupted the plan. So you had to be flexible and adaptable in that regard. But for me, from a coaching standpoint, you know, it was just an opportunity to try to, you know, lay out some of the ideas that we kind of talked about in the previous episode about how maybe I would approach working with a team or, you know, group of athletes. If I was in a college setting, you know, some of the things I'd do. So just in terms of how the practices were typically laid out, how the practice week, you know, was laid out, you know, where we had competitions, you know, how we structured the flow of practice, the design of practice, the activities, and then obviously getting, you know, a lot of feedback and ownership and adaptability from our athletes to give us, you know, input and give me input about where that the whole season could arise in that regard. So there was definitely some good things and difficult things in that regard. You know, we had athletes, you know, bouncing back, going to college practices, and then they'd come back with us for a week. We had athletes that, you know, took the semester off to, you know, to work jobs. So they're working a full-time job. So there's a whole bunch of things in there that were fairly interesting, but it was a chance for me to get my feet wet and a little bit, just trying out some things that, that, you know, if I ever got in a college setting, I'd like to try to implement that. You gave me some experience doing that in terms of more from the side of, you know, if I get back into a college setting, you know, I'd see myself more as a hybrid performance coach and like a hybrid sport coach. That's kind of like where I think there's a viability for that sort of position moving forward in our field, whether it be a skill acquisition coach, whether it be a movement specialist. You know, there's high performance coaches, but something that, you know, is really involved and they could coach, you know, whether it be a position group or side of the ball, or just, you know, in total, you have input with the head coach, but also input with the strength conditioning coach and, you know, how practice is designed, the weekly schedule, as well as the strength coach and how those things are being implemented. So I guess the most familiar term for everybody is aware of is the high performance coach, but it'd be someone maybe a little bit more hands-on, you know, it has a little bit more maybe knowledge and expertise in the actual X's and O's, the technical tackle aspects of football. So just an opportunity for me, you know, to work on that. I'm pretty comfortable with a number of positions, mostly in the offensive side of the ball. So it was good for me to get out of my comfort zone and work with, you know, different position groups that, you know, I haven't previously worked with or maybe not the most comfortable with. So it was good for me to just challenge myself as a coach to, you know, work on some new things. So I don't know if there's anything, pieces or nuggets in there you guys want to pull and travel down, but that's kind of the general breakdown.
Yeah, that's cool. I guess, like, what are some things, like, as you look back on it, what was the thing that maybe was going in? Well, I guess what's one thing that going in you were like, I'm kind of taking a risk, or, you know, this thing is this sort of idea, it would be brand new to these football athletes. Like, did you have anything like that? That was kind of like the guys were like, oh, we haven't really done this before. And then how did those things go?
Yeah. So let's see here. Look, brand new would be, I think just for all the players would be that I expected a lot of them, meaning that I asked for a lot of input from them. So they had a lot of input in terms of how our activities were designed, how our practices were designed, you know, feedback in terms of whether it be, you know, concepts, both offensively and defensively, that they wanted to see, which again, you know, being former athletes, I really never was asked a whole lot for my input in terms of whether it be game planning, whether it be structuring about, you know, what days of the week do you want rest days? What days do you think is best for the rest day? How do you, you know, whether it be the duration of practice, what kind of activities like drills do you want to do during indie, during small group, during team? You know, what are some things that you guys, you know, think that are most benefiting you guys? You know, where's the recovery day after the game? Do you like Sunday off or do you like Monday off? Or, you know, how do you want to do the film sessions, whether it be Monday or Sunday? So I think the biggest thing, those athletes, you know, they're just so used to being told what to do. And this kind of this fall was, it was really, you know, we're working this together. We're kind of co-pilots on this. And so I expect as much from you guys as you guys probably do from me. And so I know for them, it was a little bit, you know, somewhat maybe uncomfortable and awkward for them to be asked for so much input and for me demanding them input. And then when we watched film and we watch, you know, when we get NFL Game Pass and we watch NFL games, I'd be asking for them for players to study. What do they see? Ask for input from them about, you know, what makes a opposition so tough. So if I'm a receiver, what makes a defensive back so tough? Or from a defensive back, what makes a receiver, you know, challenging to defend? So asking for them for a lot of information, a lot of input to help them dig deeper into the kind of, you know, their experience in the world of football. And instead of times, you know, in college, you know, it's sometimes really passive. I think your coaches tell you exactly what you need to be doing. And I want this to be more of an active learning experience for them. So I guess it wasn't for me the most difficult thing or the most challenging or awkward thing. I think it was definitely for the players where, you know, this was a really active experience for them, which is sometimes different from what they experience, you know, in a high school or college setting.
Yeah. Even one part of that that you said made me realize, like, dang, I don't think I've ever done that. Like, I've been in football situations where, you know, we did the Sunday off. I've been in situations where we did the Monday off. I think almost everybody's trending towards the Monday off. You bring them in Sunday. But I don't know if in any of the situations, whether it was Sunday or Monday, that the decision to have Sunday or Monday off came from asking the players.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, it was, you know, me and Shadid being like, well, if we do this with, you know, flush them out, blah, blah, blah. And looking back, I'm like, I don't know if we ever asked a kid. Like,
yeah.
Which is like, you know, it doesn't matter if we think like, oh, your best recovery is going to come this. It's like if they think it comes on another day, then it comes on another day.
There's some, you know, interesting things with that. You know, the kids typically prefer to have Sunday completely off, not to come in, not to, you know, have meetings or anything like that. You know, whether it be, you know, you're their college kids, so, you know, what they're doing Saturday night obviously might influence how they feel Sunday, but. You know, most of them, you know, wanted Sunday a complete day off, just whether it be a mental, emotional break, psychological break from football. I understand. You know, this is a topic that I really interest in, that weekly plan, because there are so many things that, you know, go into it. And typically, you said, Joel, most teams are now Sunday, we're going to come and do whatever, you know, quote unquote, flush workout, a small strength conditioning, you know, range of motion, get the blood flowing, and then do meetings, right? That's typically a Sunday for most football teams. And then Monday is the full day off. That's how it was when I played as well. I understand some logistical things, you know, having a Monday off because of school. So kids can get their academics in order, like on that Monday. I understand that component. But most of the kids that, you know, we worked with, about 90% of them said they prefer Sunday off. And then most of them preferred like a Wednesday off compared to any other day. So I kind of like, you know, just, you know, how do you guys do your weekly setup, Joel, you know, in football? How do you guys do in your weekly setup?
Sunday on, Monday off.
Sunday on, Monday off. And then like Tuesday through Friday, what's that look like?
Tuesday, a little bit shorter, a little more high contact. Wednesday, definitely the fullest day. A little bit more longer down the distance, more open environments. And then we've gone back and forth. We've done both Thursday walkthrough, like, and then kind of a fast Friday. And we've also done more traditional. It was really our first year we did the walkthrough Thursday, fast Friday. And this past year we did a little more of a traditional Thursday practice with Friday walkthrough. And some of the reasoning with that was we had a super young roster. So our some of our defensive coaches more specifically were like, hey, we want to get as much practice time as possible, even if it means we're not quite as fresh for Saturday, potentially, just because we had such a young roster. They're like, we want to stretch it out a little bit more. And we're like, all right. Like, so we just ended up flipping it this past fall. But that Sunday through Wednesday night stayed consistent.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, that's, you know, that layout's, I think, becoming more and more popular, having that Thursday off. I think there's no right or wrong way, but yeah, it's just, you know, getting the players feedback. They like Sunday off. Monday was typically like a walkthrough type, you know, easy practice. And then Tuesday would be a heavy practice, Wednesday off, Thursday fairly heavy, and then Friday like a fast Friday and just Saturday. But, you know, everyone's a little bit different than that. Again, we were working with work schedules, school schedules, things like that. But it's always interesting to, you know, figure out that template, because I think that it does make a big difference. Like you said, just having athletes fast and fresh and ready and most, you know, primed and prepared for Saturday afternoon. But I always like to hear what teams are doing, because it just is interesting to me. One of my former coaches that when I played was our coach. He's at Northern State now, but at lacrosse, they actually did a study. They try to do like a high low concept. So Monday high, Tuesday low, Wednesday high, Thursday low, Friday high into Saturday. I think it just got published, but what they found was kind of what people have been iterating was their lows probably weren't low enough, and their highs might've been a little bit too high on some of those days. And their athletes quite weren't back to baseline or where they wanted them to be on Saturday afternoons or Saturday game day. So I was just, you know, I just like to think about some of the different templates and weekly schedules that teams are using, and you know, see what works best.
Yeah, and you're talking about, I mean, allowing the athletes essentially to learn essentially and figure out like what may work best for them, and I guess maybe looking at it from a traditional like collegiate strength and conditioning lens. Like how, if you were in a role at a college, how would you maybe approach it if you were a college strength coach? Because you obviously provide such a good opportunity for athletes to kind of like explore movements and have so many environments with things like parkour and rock climbing. And obviously these are younger kids, but maybe how would you approach it in a college situation?
Trying to expand like their movement capabilities and capacities like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So, you know, for us, obviously that one aspect would be, you know, addressing that from, you know, from a strength conditioning coach's lens. So, you know, wanting the strength staff to hopefully prioritize some of those things rather than just, you know, max outputs or capacities. I think, again, obviously anybody who follows me knows that I'm a firm believer in that movement abundance and adaptability and dexterity, I think, is an underpinning of high level performance. So obviously one would be in like the strength conditioning setting, kind of stuff that I like to show, where maybe some of the warmups or, you know, aspects are involved, some aspects of parkour or I don't know how you can do rock climbing in a college setting, but you could definitely do various parkour activities where they're, you know, crawling, tumbling activities where you're trying to get them to open up their movement abundance. In terms of a sport coach, we do a lot of it. Most of our indies or warmups are basically geared towards this, where we're trying to expand their movement toolbox. So we're kind of in a way forcing them to try new movements. We're forcing them to expand on their movement library. So if we're going to say a quarterback a warm up, you know, we're not doing a traditional where we're just, you know, working perfect mechanics in terms of, you know, what you see typically in a quarterback indie or quarterback warm up. We're forcing them to do different arm slots. We're forcing them to take different directional steps while they throw. So we're trying to expand that library. If we're working with a receiver, like I'm going to ask him to do, you know, a dozen different moves. But I'm going to ask him to do it kind of on air where they're trying to build the scenario and the context of how they can move it. And so while I am kind of telling them to try to try new movement, I'm allowing them some ownership in that, some freedom in that. So they have their own, kind of touch and authenticity when they do that, those exploration of their movements. So that's how I try to expand it. So our indie warmups are really geared towards kind of this exploration of movement abundance. And then the second half of warmup is typically geared towards exploitation. So how do we use these to take advantage of an opponent? How do we use these to create space and things like that? So a big piece of our warmup is exploration to try to open up their toolbox. So it's not like our traditional A skip, you know, karaoke, wherever it may be. The whole purpose is for us is to expand their movements, not, you know, confine them to, you know, this traditional warmup. So that's how I attack it with our athletes. And if I was in a college setting, that's how I'd typically try to go about it.
Okay. Now, do you provide much option for, I guess, maybe variability in loading of like maybe the traditional weight training movements? Like, just to give you an example, when we had talked to like Adam Fite, he was saying how giving the option of if it's a like a horizontal press, do you give them an option of like, hey, you can do push-up, you can do bench, you can do whatever? How do you kind of go about that lens? Are we just filling a bucket up? We're going on a general pressing movement and you give them options to go for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one way we got to go about it. So absolutely, especially with our older athletes that have some time spent in the weight room and they kind of know what, you know, feels what works for them or what doesn't work for them, what feels good, we'll definitely do that. So like you said, it's a horizontal press. You can do a straight bar bench, Swiss bar, you know, dumbbell push up, wherever, you know, wherever floats your boat, as long as we're getting a horizontal press. So that's one way to go about it. Two is, you know, we just put variable in front of our movement. So it's variable push up. What that tells them is that every single rep, they have to change their repetition. So they can change their hand position, hand width, hand orientation. So they can be offset. They can change, you know, their weight shift. They can take a foot off the ground. So we're forcing them. We're not telling them exactly what to do, but we're forcing them every single rep. You have to change, you know, how you're, you know, accomplishing this task of a push-up and allowing them some, you know, opportunities to explore and organize, you know, how they wish. So we do that on a ton of our movements in terms of even with youth athletes, we'll just, you know, whether it be, you know, a squat variation, a push, you know, variation, a suspension row. We do a lot of variable type movements in that regard. And then with what I've done to my college teams in the past is, you know, I know a lot of people get somewhat, you know, it's a more of a main compound movement, say like a hex bar deadlift or, you know, whether it be a back squat or whatever people are using for the main compound. We'll do our warmups to accomplish that. So we'll do like a, you know, a warmup with, we'll do narrow stance, the hex bar RDLs or hex bar deadlifts. So that'll be our first warm set of five. Then the next set we're going to go, you know, you got to do a wide stance, you know, and we're going to do offset weight. So one side might have, you know, 45 and a 10, the other side might have a 45. And then our third warm set, same thing. We might, you got to change your foot position. So your toes are out or toes are in or toes or feet are offset. So sometimes if, you know, if we're working some, you know, more of a heavier compound, we'll use our warm up sets to kind of express that variability within their training. And then when we get to our compound sets, whether doubles or triples, we'll keep those pretty, you know, steady, you know, working through a heavier weight. We're not going to be seeking variability. So a lot of times on our training programs, we'll put like a scale, like this is, you know, we want a high variability, like a 5 out of 5 variability, or we put like a low, like a 1. So if we're doing obviously heavier loading, our variability scale will be at a 1. If we want more variability, we're going to put that scale at a 5. So our athletes know, you know, based on that scale, where they kind of live and breathe in terms of how much, you know, exploration, how much autonomy we're giving them during that exercise or that movement.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. So thinking about it from the lens of like, so if I'm somebody who's listening to this and I'm like, man, I'm hearing more about some of the, you know, open environments, whether that's field or weight room or just like promoting variability, but I'm not, it seems like a lot, whatever I've heard, like, you know, you talk or Sean talk, like what's a good spot for me to start, whether that's in the field or on the weight room, like maybe it's the warm up like you're talking about, but like some general structure of like, I want to start inserting a little more variability. How do I do it in a way that, you know, is still, you know, you obviously have structures in place where even though it's variable, you know what you're looking for, like, I'm going to manipulate them into this type of environment, but they don't know I'm manipulating them kind of stuff. Like, how do you, like, where's a good place for people to start to think like, okay, how do I organize this overall?
Yeah, great question. So I think, you know, one would be the warm-up. That's probably the easiest place is, you know, I just personally, I, you know, I am really against kind of these overly structured militaristic type warmups where everything's done on a whistle or a clap. It just looks like, it looks like a well-oiled machine. It kind of looks good from a OCD standpoint, but I that just kills me a little bit inside. Just like, so warm-up, allowing your athletes a little bit more freedom and ownership and autonomy during that warm-up. It may not look as clean. It may look a little more sloppy, but that's how we do our warm-ups. And so how we can do that, just take whatever your traditional movements are you do for a warm-up, like do it with a partner. So like we'll just do like an ace, let's take an ace skip, for example. We still do those, but we'll do them with a partner. So I'm side to side with the partner. And when I go, wherever my pace is, my tempo, when I switch my knees, they're doing the same. My partner's doing it off of me. So they're getting this perceptual information that they must, you know, interact with, and then obviously adjust and adapt their movement based off what I'm doing. Now I'm the offensive player person. So I'm trying to be unpredictable. I'm trying to, you know, change my cadence, change my rhythm. So I'm learning now, how do I manipulate a defender? How do I create space? This is typically how you create space, by varying your tempo, being unpredictable, being sudden, not letting them, you know, kind of, you know, anticipate what you're doing. And the defender, you're getting a lot of perceptual reps. So we'll do like, you just take your basic warm-up movements. And, you know, we still do a lot of those, but we do all of them with a partner. So with it be like a karaoke, we're going to do that with a partner. So now I'm adjusting my karaoke. I can go high knee, low knee. I can go slow to all of a sudden, suddenly fast. And my partner is kind of perceiving me and moving and adapting off of what I'm doing. So they're getting a ton of perceptual reps. They're getting, they're learning how to place their eyes as a defender. You're picking up a, what kinematic information, what biomechanical information do I have to kind of, what am I, you know, searching for and scanning for that allows me to pick up when they're going to move, how they're going to move, how fast they're going to move. So I think the warmup is a huge place we could do that, not only from the perceptual standpoint in that, but also, like I said earlier, including things like tumbling and crawling and gymnastics and parkour, where they're, hey, you know, we're going to do this 24 inch box is out. Let's clear it, you know, five ways, you know, you got to have both hands out in the first rep. You can only put your left hand out for the second rep, you know, so they're allowing some chances for them to, you know, be a little more creative. When it comes to the field, I know this is a really, you know, the hot button topic. When it comes to change direction versus agility, I know a lot of people are married to change direction. What I would say with this is just change. If you're doing change direction tasks, or even if you're doing real agility tasks, is to change certain aspects of that task rep to rep. So just simply as changing your starting stance, I think is a huge thing. So we're not just doing the same 2-point, you know, linear starting stance every single time. Just change it. They can, you know, stagger their feet awkwardly. They can, you know, face at a 45 degree angle backward. Just change their stance. If you're doing some sort of, you know, change direction task where you're going to a certain distance, change that distance every single rep. So your athletes aren't just getting used to that distance and they're not just choreographing their movements to, I'm doing a 505. So every, I know it's going to go 5 yards. Well, just change that 4 yards, the second rep, 6 yards. So they're continuing to adapt and adjust their movements to new information. So it's not just them getting better, quote unquote, better at the drill. It's just them choreographing their movements because they know what the distance is. So change up where you know a person is in the environment every single time. So if we do some sort of one-on-one or two-on-one or 1v2 activities, I try to change up where the offensive person starts the position and where the defenders start their position every single rep. Because even those small nuances just add a lot of different variability and makes each repetition a little more, you know, like game-like. It looks and acts and feels more like game. So it's not, again, even, you know, agility activities can be a little bit redundant if you have your athletes starting in the same positions, the same distances, the same speeds every single time. That's not how games operate. Like, there's always going to be people from different angles, different speeds, different directions. So changing those things up rep to rep would be how I'd go to the field activities. Just change small nuances of that every single repetition. But I think those are two really easy starting places. That's where I started from an agility standpoint, was just making sure that no two reps were the same in terms of stance, starting position, distances, all that kind of stuff, time that I allow them, space that I allow them. And then the weight room started with a warm up and then slowly move to maybe it's a push up or a suspension row, something that's like an auxiliary lift. Just put variable in front of the words, variable push up. So now they know that each repetition, my push up has got to be, you know, different. So may not be as, you know, quote unquote, dangerous that coaches might be afraid of, say, a heavy, you know, double hex bar deadlift or a squat or a Bulgarian or whatever it may be. They may be a little fearful of, you know, having those compound lifts being a little more variable from rep to rep. So just use them in your auxiliary lifts. So that's how I started with it. And just it slowly kind of snowballed into now a lot of our things are, you know, include some sort of variability.
Yeah, I love that. And I even too, like, it ends up, I forget the exact study, I could find it somewhere back in Joel's show notes. I heard it on one of, Joel talked about it on a show, on one of the Just Fly ones, I forget who he was talking with. But there's, like, real research, I forget who did it, but even just looking at, like, building just the pure motor outputs is helped in those sort of variable environments. And the specific one was, they was looking at broad jump, and it was, you know, they had the group of athletes, I forget what sport, but they split them up in like half. They had this broad jump program where essentially every repetition was get as far as you can. It might've been from some different spots or, you know, twofold, threefold, whatever it was. And then the others, they had them just jumping to set cones that some were maximal, and but a fair amount of them were sub-maximal. And the team, the group that ended up, that was supposed to jump to the specific cones, even if they weren't necessarily sub-maximal, when they post-tested, that group increased their broad jump more than the team that was just max broad jumping every time. So even if you're just looking at it from like, well, I don't even care about that, I just want to build maximal outputs, like, it's there. I mean, there's evidence to show it's probably going to help you out on those maximal outputs anyway, even if you're in the mindset that you don't even care about the perception, which, yeah, I guess some people would be in that boat. But, you know, so it ends up, I mean, and I don't claim to know the reasoning behind why that variable group motor outputs increased more. But, you know, there's definitely something behind that from, you know, just like a neuroplasticity standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. The bodies have to continually adapt and adjust to that information that changes rep to rep. It is a much more powerful stimulus than, you know, like you said, just a pure physical output every single time. Again, you know, successful movement occurs because of movement variability, not, you know, in spite of it. So movement, we oftentimes think about variability as being a bad thing, you know, but it's really what underpins all successful movement. And this is, you know, on a, you know, an anecdotal from our facility. I know exactly what you're talking about with Joel with the broad jumps. We do that with vertical jumps sometimes. It's actually a little fun little games that our kids like. So we'll get on the jump pad and we'll give them two tries. I'll throw out a height like 18.5 inches. You have to get within plus or minus an inch of 18.5. So 17.5 to 19.5. You have two tries to get within that range. And so, you know, they're now having to, it's good to see them try to solve this problem. And, you know, they'll jump, they'll get 17.1 and you'll see them just going, all right, I got to adjust. You can see kind of, you can't obviously see their nervous system, but you see them, you know, trying to adjust and, you know, how am I going to, you know, solve this problem? But we'll do that for, you know, five rounds and then we'll do back to our maximum output. And same thing, acutely, we'll see those athletes on that day usually hit PRs, you know, a good majority of those athletes hit PRs. Again, you know, what the exact reason is, I don't know, but, you know, I'm sure it's the athletes having to adjust and adapt and have this variability of their movement system to solve these problems. But we kind of like that broad jump study you talked about, Joel, we have the same, you know, experience in vertical jumps in that regard. So I think, like I said, variability gets a bad rap. I know when I was a young strength coach growing up, it was all about stay consistent in your lifting programs, you know. How do you see results if you keep switching up your lifting programs, you know, every 4 weeks? But I think that is, you know, where the money is, because we are an adaptive species and we need, you know, things to adapt to. So another thing I just, you know, remembered speaking of that would be, if you're in a weight room setting and you're not real comfortable, I'd say switch your implements up week to week. So like we just went through a thing with our football guys, and for 6 weeks, we had a bench press every day of the, you know, at a certain day of the week. And we went from a straight bar to a Swiss bar to a cambered bar to a bamboo bar. So every week we just changed the same movement, but we just changed the implement. So if you're a squatter, whatever it may be, it could be back squat, front squat, cambered bar squat, safety bar squat, all those things, even though you might not think about, they add a lot of variability to the system that they have to adapt and adjust to. So I think those are powerful stimulus as well, not just continually doing the same straight bar, you know, high bar back squat every single week. Small adjustments week to week, I think, can be very powerful as well.
Yeah. I know Sam Portland, he works in United Kingdom. He's got the kind of tagged the Speedgate golf, but I don't even think if he was looking at it from that lens, but it ended up being a similar outcomes where he says like, hey, you know, you're whatever, say a kid's fly 10 yard PR is 0.95, he'd be like, hey, I want you to hit 0.99 today. And they'd be like, huh? You know, but like them trying to, you know, and they'd get a couple attempts like, hey, oh, you were 1.00, like a little bit faster, you know, they ended up, you know, he saw really great results from that. I think it started as he was introducing some like high-end max velocity work to players who hadn't really done it before. And so he wanted, that was his way of like building in to introducing it in a more scaled manner. But then long-term ended up seeing results in that same sort of vein where they're having to think about like, you know, being a little bit variable, and it ends up, you know, helping the maximal motor outputs as they go.
Yeah. Yeah. Changing the athlete's like intention, what their intentions are, will affect and influence their attention. And that will obviously has a huge role on their focus of attention of on skill acquisition and motor learning. So yeah, I just continually, you know, adapting, adjusting what the intention is for athletes. You know, I think it keeps them alert, quote unquote alert, rather than just, you know, sometimes if you do, whether it be max output or whether you just do repeated stuff, sometimes they can go in autopilot. And so all these things kind of keep our athletes off of autopilot and keep their intentions and intentions kind of coupled to the information that they're in the environment. So that's kind of how I look at it. And I think it's makes a more robust athlete than, you know, that is more adaptable when it comes to their sport than one that's not.
Yeah. I think it even translate too, like from a technical standpoint, because I mean, you kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, like one of the main things in creating space, whether you're, you know, offensively trying to create space or defensively trying to close space, is not just your maximal output, but your ability to, you know, vary your speed, you know, whether it's like a hesitation in basketball or something like that. Like, you know, like Paul Pierce got to the basket just as well as John Wall, and he's nowhere near the athlete, but he had that ridiculous hesitation and just like nobody could tell how fast he was moving. And that's, you know, maybe you're not getting better at it directly by kind of implementing those variable things in motor outputs, but it's a skill that ends up showing its head in technical tactical aspects of the sport that end up being huge. You know, like the, you know, John Wall and, you know, De'Aaron Fox are the fastest guys in the NBA, but there are other people who get to the basket just as well. You know, Kyrie Irving's one. It probably has the most ridiculous, like, change of pace in basketball, and that's what separates him. And people are like, oh, well, other guys are faster. It's like, well, he still gets the basket, so.
Yeah, that's a great point. At those levels, is the physical capacities is really – it really doesn't matter at those levels. Yeah. Now, obviously, if you're a high school kid, those physical capacities are going to make a huge difference. And so, you know, I'm a big fan of speed as anybody, but I understand that speed has a lot of, you know, is not the end all be all in terms of success for you know, field and, you know, court based athletes. You know, again, having these discussions with my football guys and from various levels, from college to NFL and whatnot. You know, I ask receivers. You know, what are some things, physical things that, you know, make a D-back really successful? What makes them hard to get open on? And speed was never mentioned. Like, I'm not fearful of speed. And that one of the reasons, Joel, is like what you said, they have to play at my fucking speed. I don't care if he runs a 4.4 and I run a 4.6. He's got to play at my 4.6. Like, what is he going to do? Just outrun me to somewhere he doesn't know where I'm going? He's got to play at my speed. And, you know, as a D-back, they always said this: speed is not a problem. I'm not afraid of speed. It's guys that can change speeds and manipulate speeds that are scary. Like these purely physical outputs, these pure, you know, fly tens, you know, once you get above high school, those things, I think, you know, matter less and less. It's about the guys that can manipulate and adjust those things that are the most deadly, most dangerous. And you get to professional level, those things matter, you know, zero. It's the guys that are deceptive, that are sudden, that can change their pace, that are really kind of attuned to the information. They can see what a defender's, how they're leaning, and they can adjust their movements like that. So again, I'm as big a fan as anybody of improving max capacities, specifically like speed. But at these high levels of qualification, it's the obviously this their ability to adapt and adjust those capacities in sport is what matters most. And so I found that interesting. And I thought back, but you know, being a receiver, yeah, and I was never afraid of a speed guy because he has to play at my speed. And so he was at the mercy of how I played. And so speed guys in some aspects, you know, weren't a huge factor on both sides of the ball. It's about guys that can, you know, obviously if they can adjust and manipulate that speed, then they're dangerous. But purely guys that play at one speed or have a high capacity for speed, but have nothing else in their repertoire, they're the guys that they're not, you know, great players.
Yeah. I've talked about that. I know with Joel, one of our better defenders on soccer is like one of our lowest output individuals on the entire team. But she is so solid at just reading the entire play and adjusting to any defender that's near her. Like there's rarely a ball that gets past her because she's able to make like the perfectly timed, like basically tackle to get the ball either out of bounds or literally just win the ball back from someone. But watching her move in general, if no one was around her, you'd be like, how is this person not getting burned every single play? But just because she has that game sense and the ability to actually adjust to the opponents around her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great, and I think every team has those players. I mean, it's, as I look back at my experiences and as a player and a coach, it's, I don't know if you guys have these same experiences, but it's crazy. How many of those type players, you know, were kind of passed up on or kind of probably lost because of their lack of physical capacities and abilities compared to the players that, you know, I can remember in college, like every year we'd have a track guy come out that ran like a 10-4, 10-5, but it could only run a straight line, couldn't catch a ball, could never get open. And like, they were given opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. While we had guys, the second, third string that, you know, couldn't break a 4-8, but knew how to create space. When they had their opportunities, they would catch the ball. They were, you know, they were agile, they were deceptive, they were sudden, and they never got the same opportunity. So physical capacities gives people those opportunities. But I just think about, you know, coaches are love and desire for the biggest, the strongest, the fastest at the expense of sometimes like those, the defensive player, like, where I think there's probably a lot of those kids that are lost and never get the quite the opportunity because they lack what we want to see, this perceived, you know, person that fits our model of what a great player should look like. So it's just interesting. I just think about that the other day, talking with an athlete, you know, every year, it was funny, every year in college, we always had the track kid to come out and, you know, ran a 10-5 and gut was just a terrible football player. And then 3 weeks in the season, they'd fucking quit. And then the third guy that was a junior who was, you know, solid, you know, was just buried in the depth chart because he couldn't break a 4-8 or 4-9. So yeah, that thing happened. Those things, I don't know. It's just difficult as a coach sometimes to why we can't sometimes get past these dogmas of what we think are, you know, every player needs to look like and act like and move like and whatnot.
Yeah. So there was a moment I had, this would have been a year and a half ago now, almost 2 years ago. Almost 3 years ago. Time flies. But it was when I was at work at Nicholls State, the Manning Passing Academy was there. And it was a moment where it was like putting together the like, oh, okay, I realized the physical outputs are like part of the equation, but then it's like the perception action and all that. And Jordan Ta'amu was there, who was the Ole Miss quarterback at the time. And DK and AJ Brown came with him. And, you know, I got to watch these guys over a week run routes and all that. And watching both of them go from, I mean, both of them are, you know, 22 and a half mile an hour type kids, and watch them go from 22 and a half to a dead stop in like a yard and a half. It was like, oh, okay. Like you're different. and then seeing them take that pure physical output and then be able to do it when a DB was on them, because, you know, you saw they ran some on like air, but then it was also some with like defenders, and it was like, oh, and they're able to do that with the defenders there to the same level. Like it didn't change at all. You could Photoshop out the defender and it would look the same. I was like, oh, okay, that's why those dudes are different. And I mean, you see it now when they both got drafted, but
People were all up on Metcalf about his pro agility, I think it was his pro agility time or eligible time was was poor, but yeah, you watch the guy, you know, play, and you can see he can move. He's not stiff. He does all those things. And same thing, I coached college football for a year, and obviously played for 5 years. But we'd always have those guys that we could at air would look pretty decent, but then you went to one on ones or Skelly, and you put defenders out there, and the opposite. What you're talking about, Joe? They would just be deer in headlights. Like, wait, on the board it was drawn up 10 yards, and I have to make a 45 degree up to a post. But what do I do when the D-back's standing right there at 10 yards? They just can't adapt or adjust. It's like, you know, that's why, you know, I'm a big proponent of not doing as much things on air for football, whether it be any position, but like receivers, especially if they do it a lot, like doing things on air, you know, how players look at, on it can be very challenging to actually determine how they look when they're going against the coverage. And so the best players, like you talked about, Joel, are the ones that look great on air, but also when you put a defender out there, are look equally as great, or if not better, they stand out even more when the defender's there, because they know how to adjust their stems, their tempos, how to manipulate a defender to keep them where they're at or move them away from where they want to go. While on air, all those things are lost. So that, you know, that's a great point.
Yeah. And I guess, yeah, I just thought of this too while you're saying it. There was a thing too, on the variability standpoint, the main show of the passing academy was the quarterbacks, obviously. And I forget who were the studs that year. It was like Jalen Hurts, and I don't think Warren showed up, but Khalil Tate was there. It was the Arizona kid. And he threw the hardest ball, like threw the fastest football out of a human being's hands I've ever seen in my life. You know, like Peyton Manning and Eli Manning were both there, like, oh my goodness. But he had no sense of varying those speeds. So the guy's running like 5 yard dig routes or 5 yard crossing routes, oh, gunning this thing and like breaking fingers. And these guys are like, what are you doing, man? And so completion percentage wasn't as high as some other dudes who could put a little touch. And they, but that was like, oh, hey, variability matters. You know, so
yeah, every receiver hates those quarterbacks. Yeah. You're running an under route, like, why can't you just lob it? What the fuck?
Yeah. So I guess a good quick segue, because we started touching on a little bit with the DK stuff. But, I mean, as we're recording, this is Thursday at 8:30. So, I mean, first round of the NFL draft is going on right now. So it was in my head today. But, you know, the combine has gotten a bad rap over the last few years, especially now that I think some of the topics that, you know, you guys – you know, like you, Sean, and Tyler Yerbian are really starting to push, and you're starting to get like real traction, kind of, I don't know if mainstream strength and conditioning or sport, but like, I feel like it's gained a lot more traction, and people are talking more about like, hey, maybe this combine stuff is pretty dumb. And I think a lot of people, if you ask them that, they recognize like, hey, do you care about this offensive tackle's three cone? I think there are a lot of smart people in a very high money business who are going to say, no, I don't care. But there's rarely the conversation of like, all right, so what are you looking for? You know, cause then, you know, when you get the talking heads on ESPN or whatever, they're just going over scenarios like who's going to take you. They're not really breaking down like, well, this left tackle is elite because of this thing he can do with his hips or whatever. So like, I guess for you, specifically now that you're like watching film scouting NFL players, but you do watch your guys move. And so like, if you're watching, we could pick specifically, you know, defensive back. When you're watching a defensive back move, yeah, we know we don't care about their three cone, their 5'10" 5, but like what are some landmarks or like attractors that you look for that would make you come out of a session saying, oh, this kid's a good mover?
Yeah. So for like a defensive back, you know, the overline, you know, theme would be, are they adaptable and dexterous in how they solve problems? So do they have many tools in their toolbox? Would be kind of the overlaying theme of what I would say that I look for. Are they adaptable, adjustable, and dexterous in how they're able to solve the problem of defending a receiver? So meaning, you know, can they play multiple different ways? If they have one tool in the toolbox, whether it be a press coverage guy or a zone type guy or a soft bail type guy, if they only have one tool in the toolbox and they don't have ways to adapt and adjust off of that, they're going to be easy guys to typically beat, unless they're just absolutely, you know, great in one of those areas. So if you look at any, you know, great player in whatever position they play, they usually have a lot of ways to, you know, whether it be counter, to adapt, to adjust to whatever they see kind of in front of them. So if you take like a good corner, like Jalen Ramsey, he's obviously a guy that can press. He can be a hard press guy. So he can basically just dig his heels in essentially and be a hard press guy, move laterally at the line of scrimmage, keep his hips square. He's got nice long leverage in arms. He can hard press you. He can soft bail out where he's just kind of inching back and waiting for the receiver to make a move. He can bail out of that. He can play zone. So a guy that has a lot of tools in their toolbox and solve, you know, can handle various amounts of problems that are presented to them in unique, authentic, organic ways is what I look for. So guys, again, if you're looking at D-back, can you handle, do you have ways to adjust and adapt to a more of a twitchy, small receiver? It's a little bit more, like I said, twitchy, change direction, a little more shaky. They rely on kind of shake to get skinny and get by guys. Versus a big guy that's trying to out-muscle you versus just a speed guy that's going to try to outrun you. Because all those different receivers present different problems. Do you have ways to adjust and adapt? And do you have different styles to adapt to all those kind of, receivers? So that's kind of the main thing that I look for, is I want them to build a deep repertoire, deep toolbox in that, you know, in that regard. I think it was, you know, Bruce Lee that said, I have no style. My style is your style. So can they adapt their style to whatever the problem in front of them is facing? Again, the old saying is, if you have your only tool in the toolbox is a hammer, you're going to find everything as a nail. And that's what we don't want. I want my athletes, you know, specifically if I'm kind of grading them or assessing them, I want them to have different tools in the toolbox to be able to handle the different problems that they're going to counter. Because they are going to encounter a lot of different problems based on the different, you know, receivers or people that they're playing against, because they are human beings. And human beings are adaptable. They're going to adjust to you. So you're going to have a counter and a counter to all of our, to all the people you're going to go against. So I'm looking for adaptability, dexterity. That's kind of the two things. It's hard to, it's not like a, you know, I don't have like a distinct description of what that looks like, or, you know, their hips move well or what, you know, it's more of, you know, just a coach's eye type thing, that, you know, they're able to adapt to all the different problems in front of them. And you'll see that in practice, because if you see three receivers, they're going to face three different types of receivers who are going to present various problems for them to tackle. And the great players will be ones that can, adapt how they play to all those different players. So they have this nuance of understanding what the other player's strengths are and ways to negate that. So it's not quite black and white, like a score on a three cone or a 5-10-5. There's a lot of nuance to that.
Yeah. But I mean, that even that level of, you know, thought, and that's going to help you. Like, if you're truly trying to like evaluate talent, it's going to help you over the long term of evaluating and helping you find people that are going to translate, because, you know, there are, I mean, I think it was Orlovsky said it about quarterbacks. He was like, you don't draft on production, you draft on projection. And you could probably say that for every position, because you can get put in situations at, you know, a college level where, oh, this one thing's working and we're super good at it because of our team is super talented in one specific area. So we can just exploit that over and over and over and over and over. You know, so-and-so might've run for 200 yards in a game because the other team was horrible at defending outside zone. So we ran outside zone a million times. You know, that'd be an extreme example, but it's, you know, you see guys who might not have had the production because of whatever reason, but if they've shown that they can solve problems in different ways, then that's what's going to potentially translate to the next level, where the number of problems that you're going to face goes, you know, up tenfold, a hundredfold, because of, you know, the different body types and the different skill levels that you're going to face. I mean, Mahomes is probably a great example. Like, he was good at Tech, but like, didn't have the career of like a Lawrence or, you know, the way that, you know, even like Mariota or Winston was at Oregon or Florida State, like you see some of these guys who had an unbelievable production, and then, and he had good production in college, but he had, you know, the skills that ended up translating, and they've clearly translated. But that's like, you know, that's probably like the golden bullet in talent evaluation is, you know, finding what actually does translate. And then like you're saying, how do we look forward on film or in person, or to make sure that it actually gets, you know, gets identified, I guess.
Yeah. And that's so difficult because it's, you know, from an evaluation standpoint, from whether it be college assessing or evaluating a high school player to recruit, or the NFL for a college player. Another thing that I think is so lost upon is, I think it's so hard to do those things without having like the athlete there or a coach part of that program there with them. That part bugs me when they don't know what they're being coached on, because that obviously changes how they're intending to move or what they're intending to do. And we can look back and say, well, we know what, you know, certain concepts and things look like, but we don't know what they're actually being taught or, you know, told, or, you know, what they're being instructed to do. So it's so hard to evaluate sometimes many of these players, because we don't have a chance to sit down and be like, hey, what's your thought process on this? What were you thinking here? What were you intending to do? You know, what was the coaching, you know, points? Anytime, you know, I watch film with my athletes, I always, that's like the first question. What does your coach tell you to do in this one? Or, you know, what was the feedback from your coach after this one? You know, what was the intention for your on this route or this coverage or whatever this may be? Because those things play such a huge role in terms of evaluating and understanding what, you know, the athlete has in their toolbox in that regard. So, and that, you know, many times like Mahomes is a perfect example. Justin Jefferson is a perfect example where these guys, in many cases, they thought that these guys' creativity, their, you know, their want or need to, you know, break a play down or in, you know, make an adjustment was a downside to their performance. Like Mahomes was like, he's not a, you know, traditional passer because he's always throwing from different angles and he's always breaking out of the pocket to try to make a play. Well, really, that's his strength. And that, if you've seen in the NFL, that's what his most powerful thing is, his ability to adapt and adjust. But coming out of college, it was a negative towards him for some reason. And then all that also matters in terms of what system or what you're trying to ask these athletes. And, you know, but, you know, I think coaches, sometimes they do a great job. Other times they don't. Like Reed's done a great job. He plays to Mahomes' strength. By other, I'm sure, I'm guaranteeing, I think it was even Gruden said coming, you know, he was doing the quarterback camp at that time. He wasn't quite the head coach of the Raiders yet. But he's like, if you were my quarterback, I would make sure you wouldn't be doing that shit. Like, so you're going to take this guy's greatest strength, his ability to create and change his arm angles and change his arm slots and throw off his back foot. You're just going to try to erase that from him because it doesn't fit your quote unquote model of what a perfect quarterback looks like. That happens, I think, a lot more than we like to think. And so it depends on the coaches you get, the systems you get. So all those things influence, you know, athletes' ability to be successful at the next level in that regard. And so, yeah, I mean, there's guys that quote unquote fit these models that coaches want to see and other guys that don't. But if some guys that don't fit the model, I think the skills that coaches are, you know, detracting them from are usually them being really creative and them, you know, maybe trying to be a little bit more, you know, trying to create plays when, you know, maybe they're not there. So like Jefferson's big knock was he did, you know, too many double moves, or he wasn't as quote unquote fluid like other receivers. But you watch a guy in the NFL, that's what he is so good at, is he's so hard to defend because he's kind of unorthodox. He kind of does a lot of, you know, duck steps or waddle steps where he's in and out of breaks two or three different times. And you just don't see those things. And so that's what his strength is. And, you know, Minnesota allowed him to play like that. So that, you know, why he's so successful. But many other programs are like, that's not what I look for. We want guys that just run and, you know, run it exactly how we draw it up. We don't want to deviate from our plan. The highest level performers are the ones that are able to deviate from their plan, but still kind of be on time, be on pace and things like that. So yeah, it's interesting. It's a tough topic that if anybody had the way to evaluate talent, you know, they'd be a rich person.
Yeah. No doubt.
Yeah. Another, if you guys are interested in that, a friend of mine, Matt Caraccio, is made really big headwaves in terms of how he goes about, assessing, evaluating college talent for the NFL. He's got a really interesting template and model that he's using. and he's using it in this, he's using kind of like dexterity as its main driver, and how these athletes are solving problems. Are they solving them authentically? Are they solving them rationally and resourcefully and quickly and authentically? So he's using this kind of this template from Bernstein, dexterity and development. He's using this kind of template to evaluate college prospects for the NFL. And I think he's going to make some big waves with, you know, where he goes with it moving forward compared to just the traditional. He's 6'4", 210, and runs a 4.4. And so his, you know, with that spiderweb scale, he ranks really high. He's moving on well beyond that in terms of how athletes are, you know, solving problems and trying to just understand more of the nuance and the, you know, what is the information and the environment telling this athlete and how they interacting with that and how they adapting to that, because the athletes that are really, you know, attuned to that environment and that information and can adapt and adjust and be dexterous are the ones that are most successful at every level. So it's, you know, the physical passes are important, but it's those athletes that can do those things that we're seeing, especially now in today's game, where we're letting athletes be a little bit more authentic and we're giving them some more, a longer leash. Those athletes are the ones that are the most successful. So his grading scale, his evaluation scale is really interesting.
Cool. Yeah, I'll have to message you after this and so you can link us to that. That's really solid. Cool. Well, I think that's probably a good spot to wrap up. That's right about an hour. I know we appreciate you coming on. I feel like we both times we've talked, it flies by because we're just chatting. Yeah. But I'm sure we'll have you on again at some point, because I already have questions that popped up for me that I'm like, oh, I could go implement that and then ask them about it later and some things like that. So that's, I really enjoyed this, and thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks again.
All right, thanks for tuning in, everybody. That was episode 40 of the Sprint Jump Throw Performance Podcast with Michael Zweifel. I hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you next episode.